Chapter 2. Becca Paulson. 1. Rebecca Bouchard Paulson was married to Joe Paulson, one of Haven's two mail carriers and one-third of Haven's postal staff. Joe was cheating on his wife, something Bobby Anderson already knew. Now Becca Paulson knew it as well. She had known it for the last 3 days. Jesus told her. In the last 3 days or so, Jesus had told her the most amazing, terrible, distressing things imaginable. They sickened her. They destroyed her sleep. They were destroying her sanity. But weren't they also sort of wonderful? Boy, howdy. And would she stop listening? Maybe just tip Jesus over on his face or scream at him to shut up? Absolutely not. For one thing, there was a grisly sort of compulsion in knowing the things Jesus told her. For another, he was the Savior. Jesus was on top of the Paulson Sony TV. He had been there for just 6 years. Before that, he had rested atop two zeniths. Becca estimated that Jesus had been in roughly the same spot for about 16 years. Jesus was represented in lifelike 3D. This was a picture of him that Becca's older sister Corrine, who lived in Portsmouth, had given them as a wedding present. When Joe commented that Becca's sister was a little on the cheap side, wasn't she? Becca told him to hush up. Not that she was terribly surprised. You couldn't expect a man like Joe to understand the fact that you couldn't put a price tag on true beauty. In the picture, Jesus was dressed in a simple white robe and holding a shepherd's staff. The Christ on Becca's TV combed his hair a little bit like Elvis Presley after Elvis got out of the army. Yes, he looked quite a bit like Elvis in G.I. Blues. His eyes were brown and mild. Behind him, in perfect perspective, sheep as white as the linens in TV soap commercials trailed off and over the horizon. Becca and Corrine had grown up on a sheep farm in New Gloucester, and Becca knew from personal experience that sheep were never that white and uniformly woolly, like little fair-weather clouds fallen to earth. But, she reasoned, if Jesus could turn water into wine and bring the dead back to life, there was no reason at all why he couldn't make the shit caked around a bunch of lamb's rumps disappear if he wanted to. A couple of times Joe had tried to move that picture off the TV, and she supposed that now she knew why. Oh, yes siree. Boy, howdy. Joe, of course, had his trumped-up tales. "Doesn't seem right to have Jesus on top of the television while we're watching Magnum or Miami Vice," he'd say. "Why not put it up on your bureau, Becca?" Or, "I'll tell you what, why not put it up on your bureau until Sunday? Then you can bring it down and put it back while you watch Jimmy Swaggart and Jack Van Impe. I'll bet Jesus likes Jimmy Swaggart a hell of a lot better than he likes Miami Vice." She refused. Another time he said, "When it's my turn to have the Thursday night poker game, the guys don't like it. No one wants to have Jesus Christ looking at him while he tries to draw to an inside straight. Maybe they feel uncomfortable because they know gambling's the devil's work," Becca said. Joe, a good poker player, bridled. "And it was the devil's work brought you your blow dryer and that garnet ring you like so well," he said. "Better take 'em back for refunds and give the money to the Salvation Army. I think I got the receipts in my den." So she allowed Joe to turn the 3D picture of Jesus around on the one Thursday night a month that he had his dirty-talking, beer-swilling friends in to play poker. But that was all. And now she knew the real reason he had wanted to get rid of that picture. He must have had the idea all along that that picture might be a magic picture. Oh, she supposed sacred was a better word. Magic was for pagans, headhunters, and cannibals, and Catholics, and people like that. But they almost came to the same thing, didn't they? Anyway, Joe must have sensed that picture was special, that it would be the means by which his sin would be found out. Oh, she supposed she had known something was going on. He was never after her at night anymore, and while that was something of a relief, Sex was just as her mother had told her it would be, nasty, brutish, sometimes painful, always humiliating. She had also smelled perfume on his collar from time to time, and that was not a relief at all. She supposed she could have ignored the connection. The fact that the pawings had stopped at the same time that occasional smell of perfume started showing up in his collars, indefinitely, if the picture of Jesus on top of the Sony hadn't begun to speak on July 7th. She could even have ignored a third factor. At about the same time the pawings had stopped and the perfume smells had begun, old Charlie Estabrook had retired from the post office, and a woman named Nancy Voss had come up from the Augusta post office to take his place. She guessed that the Voss woman, whom Becca now thought of as simply the hussy, was perhaps 5 years older than she and Joe, which would make her around 50, but she was a trim, well-kept 50. Becca would admit she herself had put on a little weight, going from 126 to 203, most of that since Byron, their only chick, had left home. She could have ignored it, would have ignored it, perhaps even have come to tolerate it with relief, if the hussy enjoyed the animalism of sexual congress with its gruntings and thrustings and that final squirt of sticky stuff that smelled faintly like codfish and looked like cheap dish detergent, then it only proved the hussy was little more than an animal herself. Also, it freed Becca of a tiresome, if ever more occasional, obligation. She could have ignored it, that was, if the picture of Jesus hadn't spoken up. It happened for the first time at just past 3 p.m. on Thursday. Becca was coming back into the living room from the kitchen with a little snack, half a coffee cake and a beer stein filled with cherry Zarex, to watch General Hospital. She could no longer really believe that Luke and Laura would ever come back, but she was not able to completely give up hope. She was bending down to turn on the TV when Jesus said, "Becca, Joe is putting it to that hussy down at the P.O. just about every lunch hour, and sometimes after quitting time, too. Once he was so ranty he put it to her while he was supposed to be helping her sort the mail. And do you know what? She never even said, 'At least wait until I get the first class took care of.'" "And that's not all," Jesus said. He walked halfway across the picture, his robe fluttering around his ankles, and sat down on a rock that jutted from the ground. He held his staff between his knees and looked at her grimly. "There's a lot going on in Haven. You won't believe the half of it." Becca screamed again and fell on her knees. "My Lord!" she shrieked. One of her knees landed squarely on her piece of coffee cake, which was roughly the size and thickness of the family Bible, squirting raspberry filling into the face of Ozzie, the cat, who had crept out from under the stove to see what was going on. "My Lord! My Lord!" Becca continued to shriek. Ozzie ran, hissing, for the kitchen, where he crawled under the stove again with red goo dripping from his whiskers. He stayed there the rest of the day. "Well, none of the Paulsons was ever good for much," Jesus said. A sheep wandered toward him and he whacked it away, using his staff with an absent-minded impatience that reminded Becca, even in her current frozen state, of her late father. The sheep went, rippling slightly because of the 3D effect. It disappeared, actually seeming to curve as it went off the edge of the picture. But that was just an optical illusion, she felt sure. "No, sir," Jesus declared. "Joe's great-uncle was a murderer, as you well know, Becca. Murdered his son, his wife, and then himself. And when he came up here, do you know what we said? No room, that's what we said." Jesus leaned forward, propped on his staff. "Go see Mr. Splitfoot down below," we said. "You'll find your Haven home all right. But you may find your new landlord asks a hell of a high rent and never turns down the heat," we said. Incredibly, Jesus winked at her, and that was when Becca fled, shrieking, from the house. 2. She stopped in the backyard, panting, her mousy blonde hair hanging in her face, her heart beating so fast that it frightened her. No one had heard her shriekings and carryings on, thank the Lord. She and Joe lived far out on the Nista Road, and their nearest neighbors were the Brodskys, who lived in that slutty trailer. The Brodskys were half a mile away. That was good. Anyone who had heard her would have thought there was a crazy woman down at the Paulsons. Well, there is, isn't there? If you think that picture started to talk, why, you must be crazy. Daddy'd beat you three shades of blue for saying such a thing. One for lying, another for believing it, and a third for raising your voice. Becca, pictures don't talk. No, nor did it, another voice spoke up suddenly. That voice came out of your own head, Becca. I don't know how it could be, how you could know such things, but that's what happened. You made that picture of Jesus talk your own self, like Edgar Bergen used to make Charlie McCarthy talk on the Ed Sullivan Show. But somehow that idea seemed more frightening, more downright crazy, than the idea that the picture itself had spoken, and she refused to allow it mental house room. After all, miracles happened every day. There was that Mexican fellow who had found a picture of the Virgin Mary baked into an enchilada or something. There were those miracles at Lourdes, not to mention those children that had made the headlines of one of the tabloids. They had cried rocks. Those were bona fide miracles. The children who wept rocks was, admittedly, a rather gritty one, as uplifting as a Pat Robertson sermon. Hearing voices was just nuts. But that's what happened. And you've been hearing voices for quite a while now, haven't you? You've been hearing his voice. Joe's. And that's where it came from. Not from Jesus, but from Joe. No, Becca whimpered. I ain't heard any voices in my head. She stood by her clothesline in the backyard, looking blankly off toward the woods on the other side of the Nister Road. They were hazy in the heat. Less than half a mile into those woods as the crow flew, Bobby Anderson and Jim Gardner were steadily unearthing more and more of a titanic fossil in the earth. Crazy, her dead father's implacable voice told in her head. Crazy with the heat. You come on over here, Becca Bouchard, I'm going to beat you three shades of blister blue for that crazy talk.
I ain't heard no voices in my head, Becca moaned. That picture really did talk, I swear. I can't do ventriloquism.
Better the picture. If it was the picture, it was a miracle, and miracles came from God. A miracle could drive you nuts, and dear God knew she felt like she was going nuts right now. But it didn't mean you were crazy to start with. Hearing voices in your head, however, or believing that you could hear other people's thoughts. Becca looked down and saw blood gushing from her left knee. She shrieked again and ran back into the house to call the doctor, medics, somebody, anybody. She was in the living room again, pawing at the dial with the phone to her ear when Jesus said,
That's just raspberry filling from your coffee cake, Becca. Why don't you just cool it before you have a heart attack?
She looked at the Sony, the telephone receiver falling to the table with a clunk. Jesus was still sitting on the rock outcropping. It looked as though he had crossed his legs. It was really surprising how much he looked like her father. Only, he didn't seem forbidding, ready to be angry at a moment's notice. He was looking at her with a kind of exasperated patience.
Try it and see if I'm not right, Jesus said.
She touched her knee gently, wincing, anticipating pain. There was none. She saw the seeds and the red stuff and relaxed. She licked the raspberry filling off her fingers.
Also, Jesus said, you have got to get these ideas about hearing voices and going crazy out of your head. It's just me, and I can talk to anyone I want to, any way I want to.
Because you're the Savior, Becca whispered.
Right, Jesus said.
He looked down. Below him, on the screen, a couple of animated salad bowls were dancing in appreciation of the Hidden Valley Ranch dressing which they were about to receive.
And I'd like you to please turn that crap off, if you don't mind. We can't talk with that thing running. Also, it makes my feet tingle.
Becca approached the Sony and turned it off.
My Lord, she whispered.
3. The following Sunday afternoon, Joe Paulson was lying fast asleep in the backyard hammock with Ozzie the cat zonked out on Joe's ample stomach. Becca stood in the living room, holding the curtain back and looking at Joe, sleeping in the hammock, dreaming of his hussy, no doubt, dreaming of throwing her down in a great big pile of catalogs and Woolco circulars, and then, how would Joe and his piggy poker buddies put it, putting the shoes to her. She was holding the curtain with her left hand because she had a handful of square 9-volt batteries in her right. She took the batteries into the kitchen, where she was assembling something on the kitchen table. Jesus had told her to make it. She told Jesus she couldn't make things. She was clumsy. Her daddy had always told her so. She thought of adding how he sometimes told her he was surprised she could wipe her own butt without an instruction manual, and then decided that wasn't the sort of thing you told the Savior. Jesus told her not to be a fool. If she could follow a recipe, she could build this little thing. She was delighted to find that he was absolutely right. It was not only easy, it was fun. More fun than cooking, certainly. She had never really had the knack for that either. Her cakes fell, and her breads never rose. She had begun this little thing yesterday, working with the toaster, the motor from her old Hamilton Beach blender, and a funny board full of electronics things which had come from the back of an old radio in the shed. She thought she would be done long before Joe woke up and came in to watch the Red Sox game on TV at 2 o'clock. She picked up his little blowtorch and lit it deftly with a kitchen match. She would have laughed a week ago if you'd told her she would be working with a propane torch now. But it was easy. Jesus told her exactly how and where to solder the wire to the electronics board from the old radio. That wasn't all Jesus had told her during the last 3 days. He had told her things that murdered her sleep, that made her afraid to go into the village and do her shopping lest her guilty knowledge show on her face. "I'll always know when you done something wrong, Becca," her father had told her, "because you ain't got the kind of face can keep a secret." That had, for the first time in her life, made her lose her appetite. Joe, totally bound up in his work, the Red Sox, and his hussy, noticed hardly anything amiss, although he had seen Becca gnawing her fingernails the other night as they watched Hill Street Blues, and nail-biting was something she had never done before, was, in fact, one of the things she nagged him about. Joe Paulson considered this for all of 12 seconds before looking back at the Sony TV and losing himself in dreams of Nancy Voss's heaving white breasts. Among others, these were a few of the things Jesus told her, causing Becca to sleep poorly and to begin biting her fingernails at the advanced age of 45. In 1973, Moss Harlingen, one of Joe's poker buddies, had murdered his father. They had been hunting deer up in Greenville, and it had supposedly been one of those tragic accidents. But the shooting of Abel Harlingen had been no accident. Moss simply laid up behind a fallen tree with his rifle and waited until his father splashed across a small stream about 50 yards down the hill from where Moss was. Moss potted his father as easily as a clay duck in a shooting gallery. He thought he had killed his father for money. Moss's business, Big Ditch Construction, had 2 notes falling due with 2 different banks within 6 weeks' time, and neither would extend because of the other. Moss went to Abel, but his dad refused to help, although he could afford to. So Moss shot his father and inherited a pot of money after the county coroner handed down a verdict of death by a misadventure. The notes were paid, and Moss Harlingen really believed, except perhaps in his deepest dreams, that he had committed murder for gain. The real motive had been something else. Far in the past, when Moss was 10 and his brother Emery 7, Abel's wife went south to Rhode Island for 1 whole winter. Her brother had died suddenly, and his wife needed help getting on her feet. While their mother was gone, there were several incidents of buggery at the Harlingen place. The buggery stopped when the boy's mother came back, and the incidents were never repeated. Moss had forgotten all about them. He never remembered lying awake in the dark anymore, lying awake in mortal terror and watching the doorway for the shadow of his father. He had absolutely no recollection of lying with his mouth pressed against his forearm, salty tears of shame and rage squeezing out of his hot eyes and coursing down his cold face to his mouth, as Abel Harlingen slathered lard onto his cock and slid it up his son's back door with a grunt and a sigh. It had all made so little impression on Moss that he could not remember biting his arm until it bled to keep from crying out. And he certainly could not remember Emery's breathless bird cries from the next bed. "Please, Daddy. No, Daddy, please not me tonight. Please, Daddy." Children, of course, forget very easily. But some memory might have lingered, because when Moss Harlingen actually pulled the trigger on the buggering son of a whore, as the echoes first rolled away and then rolled back, finally disappearing into the great forested silence of the up Maine wilderness, Moss whispered, "Not you, Em. Not tonight." Alice Kimball, who taught at the Haven Grammar School, was a lesbian. Jesus told Becca this on Friday, not long after the lady herself, looking large and solid and respectable in a green pantsuit, had stopped by collecting for the American Cancer Society. Darla Gaines, the pretty 17-year-old girl who brought the Sunday paper, had half an ounce of bitchin' reefer between the mattress and box spring of her bed. Jesus told Becca this right after Darla had come on Saturday to collect for the last 5 weeks, $3 plus a 50-cent tip Becca now wished she had withheld, and that she and her boyfriend smoked the reefer in Darla's bed before having intercourse, only they called having intercourse doing the horizontal bop. They smoked reefer and did the horizontal bop almost every weekday afternoon from 2:30 until 3 or so. Darla's parents both worked at Splendid Shoe and Dairy, and they didn't get home until well past 4. Hank Buck, another of Joe's poker cronies, worked at a large supermarket in Bangor and hated his boss so much that a year ago he had put half a box of X-Lax in the man's chocolate shake when the boss had sent Hank out to get his lunch at McDonald's one day. The boss had something rather more spectacular than a bowel movement. At 3:15 that day, he had done something in his pants that was the equivalent of a shit A-bomb. The A-bomb, or S-bomb, if you preferred, had gone off as he was slicing lunch meat in the deli of Paul's Down East Supermart. Hank managed to keep a straight face until quitting time, but by the time he got into his car to go home, he was laughing so hard he almost shit his own pants. Twice he had to pull off the road, he got laughing so hard. "Laughed," Jesus told Becca. "What do you think of that?" Becca thought it was a low-down mean trick, and such things were only the beginning, it seemed. Jesus knew something unpleasant or upsetting about everyone Becca came in contact with, it seemed. She couldn't live with such an awful outpouring. She couldn't live without it, either. One thing was certain. She had to do something about it. "You are," Jesus said. He spoke from behind her, from the picture on top of the Sony. Of course he did. The idea that his voice was coming from inside her own head, that she was somehow, well, somehow reading people's thoughts, that was only a dreadful passing illusion. It must be. That alternative was horrifying. Satan, witchcraft. "In fact," Jesus said, confirming his existence with that dry, no-nonsense voice, so like her father's, "you're almost done with this part. Just solder that red wire to that point to the left of the long doohickey. No, not there, there. Good girl. Not too much solder, mind. It's like Brill Cream, Becca. A little dab'll do you." Strange, hearing Jesus talk about Brill Cream. 4. Joe woke up at 1:45, tossed Ozzie off his lap, strolled to the back of his lawn, brushing cat hairs off his T-shirt, and had a comfortable whiz into the poison ivy back there. Then he headed into the house. Yankees and Red Sox. Great. He opened the fridge, glancing briefly at the snippets of wire on the counter, and wondering just what in the hell that dim-bulb Becca had been up to. But mostly he dismissed it. He was thinking of Nancy Voss. He was wondering what it would feel like to squirt off between Nancy's tits. He thought maybe Monday he'd find out. He squabbled with her. Christ, sometimes they squabbled like a couple of dogs in August. Seemed like it wasn't just them. Everyone seemed short-fused lately.
but when it came to fucking, son of a bitch. He hadn't been so randy since he was 18, and she was the same way. Seemed like neither of them could get enough. He'd even squirted in the night a couple of times. It was like he was 16 again. He grabbed a quart of Bud and headed toward the living room. Boston was almost certainly going to win today. He had the odds figured at 8-5. Lately, he seemed to have an amazing head for odds. There was a guy down in Augusta who'd take bets, and Joe had made almost 500 bucks in the last 3 weeks. Not that Becca knew. He'd rat-holed it. It was funny. He'd know exactly who was going to win and why. And then he'd get down to Augusta and forget the why and only remember the who. But that was the important thing, wasn't it? Last time, the guy in Augusta had grumbled, paying off at 3-1 on a $20 bet. Mets against the Pirates. Gooden on the mound, looked like a cinch for the Mets. But Joe had taken the Pirates, and they'd won, 5-2. Joe didn't know how much longer the guy in Augusta would take his bets. But if he stopped, so what? There was always Portland. There were two or three books there. It seemed like lately he got a headache whenever he left Haven. Needed glasses, maybe. But when you were rolling hot, a headache was a small price to pay. Enough money and the two of them could go away, leave Becca with Jesus. That was who Becca wanted to be married to anyway. Cold as ice, she was. But that Nancy? One hot ticket. And smart? Why, just today she'd taken him out back at the P.O. to show him something. Look! Look what I thought of. I think I ought to patent it, Joe. I really do. What idea? Joe asked. The truth was, he felt a little mad with her. The truth was, he was more interested in her tits than her ideas, and mad or not, he was already getting a blue steeler. It really was like being a kid again. But what she showed him was enough to make him forget all about his blue steeler. For at least 4 minutes, anyway. Nancy Voss had taken a kid's Lionel train transformer and hooked it somehow to a bunch of D-cell batteries. This gadget was wired to 7 flour sifters with their screens knocked out. The sifters were lying on their sides. When Nancy turned on the transformer, a number of filament-thin wires hooked to something that looked like a blender began to scoop first-class mail from a pile on the floor into the sifters, seemingly at random. "What's it doing?" Joe asked. "Sorting the first class," she said. She pointed at one sifter after another. "That one's Haven Village. That's RFD1, Dairy Road, you know. That one's Ridge Road. That one's Nister Road. That one's..." He didn't believe it at first. He thought it was a joke, and he wondered how she'd like a slap upside the head. "Why'd you do that?" she'd whine. "Some men can take a joke," he'd answer, like Sylvester Stallone in that movie Cobra, "but I ain't one of them." Except then he saw it was really working. It was quite a gadget, all right. But the sound of the wires scraping across the floor was a little creepy, harsh and whispery, like big old spider's legs. It was working, all right. Damned if he knew how, but it was. He saw one of the wires snag a letter for Roscoe Tebolt and push it into the correct sifter, RFD2, which was the Hammercut Road, even though it had been misaddressed to Haven Village. He wanted to ask her how it worked, but he didn't want to look like a goddamn dummy, so he asked her where she got the wires instead. "Out of these telephones I bought at Radio Shack," she said. "The one at the Bangor Mall. They were on sale. There's some other stuff from the phones in it, too. I had to change everything around, but it was easy. It just, you know, come to me. You know?" "Yeah," Joe said slowly, thinking about the bookie's face when Joe had come in to collect his 60 bucks after the Pirates beat Gooden and the Mets. "Not bad for a woman." For a moment, her brow darkened, and he thought, "You want to say something? You want to fight? Come on, that's okay. That's just about as okay as the other." Then her brow cleared and she smiled. "Now we can do it even longer." Her fingers slid down the hard ridge in his pants. "You do want to do it, don't you, Joe?" And Joe did. They slipped to the floor and he forgot all about being mad at her,
and how all of a sudden he seemed to be able to figure the odds on everything from baseball games to horse races to golf matches in the wink of an eye. He slid into her, and she moaned, and Joe even forgot the tenebrous whispering sound those wires made as they sifted the first-class mail into the row of flower sifters. 5. When Joe entered the living room, Becca was sitting in her rocker, pretending to read the latest issue of The Upper Room. Just 10 minutes before Joe came in, she had finished wiring the gadget Jesus had shown her how to make into the back of the Sony TV. She followed his instructions to the letter, because he said you had to be careful when you were fooling around inside the back of a television. "You could fry yourself," Jesus advised. "More juice back there than is in a bird's-eye warehouse, even when it's turned off." The TV was off now, and Joe said ill-temperedly, "I thought you'd have it all warmed up for me." "I guess you know how to turn on the damn TV," Becca said, speaking to her husband for the last time. Joe raised his eyebrows. Damned anything was damned odd, coming from Becca. He thought about calling her on it, and decided to let it ride. Could be there was one fat old mare who'd find herself keeping house by herself before much of a longer went by. "Guess I do," Joe said, speaking to his wife for the last time. He pushed the button that turned the Sony on, and better than 2,000 volts of current slammed into him. AC, which had been boosted, switched over to lethal DC, and then boosted again. His eyes popped wide open, bulged, and then burst like grapes in a microwave. He had started to set the quart of beer on top of the TV next to Jesus. When the electricity hit, his hand clenched tightly enough to break the bottle. Spears of brown glass drove into his fingers and palm. Beer foamed and ran. It hit the top of the TV, its plastic casing already blistering, and turned to steam that smelled like yeast. Joe Paulson screamed. His face began to turn black. Blue smoke poured out of his hair and his ears. His finger was nailed to the Sony's on button. A picture popped on the TV. It was Dwight Gooden throwing the wild pitch that let in 2 runs and chased him, making Joe Paulson $40 richer. It flipped and showed him and Nancy Voss screwing on the post office floor in a litter of catalogs and congressional newsletters and ads from insurance companies saying you could get all the coverage you needed even if you were over 65. No salesman would call at your door. No physical examination would be required. Your loved ones would be protected at a cost of pennies a day. "No!" Becca screamed, and the picture flipped again. Now she saw Moss Harlingen behind a fallen pine, notching his father in the sight of his 30-30 and murmuring, "Not you, Em, not tonight." It flipped, and she saw a man and a woman digging in the woods, the woman behind the controls of something that looked a little bit like a payloader and a little bit like something out of a Rube Goldberg cartoon, the man looping a chain around a stump. Beyond them, a vast, dish-shaped object jutted out of the earth. It was silvery but dull. The sun struck it in places, but it did not twinkle. Joe Paulson's clothes burst into flame. The living room was filled with the smell of cooking beer. The 3D picture of Jesus jittered around and then exploded. Becca shrieked, understanding that, like it or not, it had been her all along. Her, her, her. And she was murdering her husband. She ran to him, seized his looping, spasming hand, and was herself galvanized. "Jesus, oh, Jesus, save him, save me, save us both," she thought as the current slammed into her, driving her up on her toes like the world's heftiest ballerina, on point. And a mad, cackling voice, the voice of her father, rose in her brain. "Fooled you, Becca, didn't I? Fooled you good, teach you to lie, teach you for good and all." The rear of the television, which she had screwed back on after she had finished adding her alterations, blew back against the wall with a mighty blue flash of light. Becca tumbled to the carpet, pulling Joe with her. Joe was already dead. By the time the smoldering wallpaper behind the TV had ignited the chintz curtains, Becca Paulson was dead too.